Jeff Ogilvie survives Wingfoot.
Now the moment Aaron Bradley has waited.
Curry Webb is the five-time Australian Open champion.
Golf at its best by one of the best in golf, Peter Thompson.
Standing in front of a crowd like this today and win the PGA Championship is pretty special.
He's done it at last. Greg Norman.
Matt Jones gets his name on the Stonehaven Cup.
Leash been to 11 under. Now we've got a new leader, kids.
Here it is! Adam Scott. A life changer. Coming up next, you have unrestricted access to golf across Australia and the world. Thanks to Golf Australia, we're going inside the ropes.
G'day everybody, welcome to Inside the Ropes, episode 4, one of the great weeks in the world of golf. Of course, any major week is exactly that. We are sitting down Thursday Australian time in the AM. Of course, by the time most of you are listening to this, I imagine there's been balls struck in anger over at Erin Hills, and the story is beginning to be told. We've got a lot to look forward to. Jeff Ogilvie not too far away from joining us, which is magnificent. Mark Hayes, lovely to see you again.
Thank goodness for M alliterations. I've been called a lot of things, but that was lovely. Thank right. you.
We're joined by golfing royalty in this fair nation of ours today. We thought we were lucky to have Martin Blake in the house last week. Well, this play just blows him right out of the water. Hello, Mike Clayton.
Andy, how's it?
Yeah, okay, things are going well. I know you're a reasonably measured, sort of balanced individual. Yeah. Do you, all the golf that you've seen and all the golf that you've played, do you get a little excited at all for major championship weeks?
Yeah, they're fun. They're always fun. Yeah, I do. I enjoy the... Except for the PGA. I'm not, right. I can't get up for the PGA, which I wish the... I mean, the US PGA, they're going to move it into May. I mean, why don't they move it every Olympic year? Move it around the world. Do something interesting with it. So, you know, everyone loves the Masters and the Open and the US Open. But no, there's no love for the PGA because who would care about it?
I wondered why you had your finger over the dump button, Mark.
No.
I had no idea that it was going to, you know, need the call from the PGA of America so early to just, you know, hit abandon.
This is a dump button free zone here. Yeah, no, anything
so,
goes.
I'm kidding. So the PGA needs to move around the once every 4 years, move it around the world. It would be, and then it would garner some love, and it would be great for that tournament. And
it'll never happen.
No, it'll never happen. But
I'm going to ask our first guest about that. I think that's an important thing for the future of golf.
Well, I think we probably know where Jeff Ogilvie would stand on such a thing. It is just good for the game of golf, but it will never happen.
I mean, if you were starting again, tennis got it right, but I assume more by accident than design. But Australia, Paris, London, America is perfect. Mm. But why are there three majors in America?
Yeah. Well, the WGC, as we all know, was designed to sort of alleviate that problem.
The World Championship events, all in America. That's
great. Right.
Yeah. Oh, no, we'll go to Mexico. Oh,
there's one in Mexico. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Well, that'll stop once the wall gets built. They won't be able to get through it. No, that's right. Yeah. Do you like the... this is a question I'm really keen to ask Jeff about, having sort of battled through many, many of them. But do you like the personality of the US Open? Do you... I mean, you're a course designer and one that is, you know, rightfully earning great regard for the work you and your company are doing around the world. But so you have strong views on what courses, golf courses, should be like. But for this one-off event, do you like the way they set courses up?
Well, they've changed the last few years. Pinehurst, no rough. Chambers Bay, wide and bouncy. Erin Hills, wide and windy. And but the traditional. Every single year, 25, 30-yard wide fairways, high rough down the sides, high rough around the greens. It was the same every year, and it was deadly boring, and it wasn't the best way to find the best players in the world because the Masters and the British Open did that much better than the US Open, if you look at the history of winners, I think, because there's no rough at Augusta, and there's not generally that much rough at the Open, aside from the debacle at Carnoustie, and when Greg won at Turnberry in 86, that was a mess too, but... Mostly the British Open's terrific at getting the course set up right. But America was so formulaic. It was so much about long grass. And Jeff will talk about it. But, you know, they try and find straight drivers. But no one drives straight enough to find the fairways that often. So really it comes down to who can pitch it out and get up and down from 100 yards.
So there's been a bit said about that this week. We'll get Jeff on the line in a moment. But Kevin Na pretty much set the ball rolling, Hazy. And we may not necessarily like watching Kevin Na play his golf because it becomes a bit of a grueling experience for many of us to watch him play the game. But he did, I don't know, Monday or Tuesday afternoon, their time over there, put out a little Instagram feed video. This is what Kevin Na had to say.
We're at the US Open, Aaron Hills. Let me show you what we're dealing with this week. You got 3 to 4 yards of rough, maybe 5 at the most, and then you got fescue. I'm going to throw a ball in there. Literally, I threw it literally 3 yards. Now, you're lucky if you find your ball. Now, I just moved grass, and I found it. And I'm going to play out of here. See, it's like a hazard. Every hole, we got this. Every hole.
No chance.
Nope. Didn't move. Moved the foot. Now I can't find it. Now, why can't we have a lot of the past U.S. Open winners get together and set up a major? I like to see that happen one day.
So there's Kevin R.
But here's what's so silly about that. I mean, the rough was stupid at where it was, but we just saw the Players' Championship at Sawgrass the other day. And I'll guarantee that hole he was on at Aaron Hills is 50 yards wider than the 18th fairway at Sawgrass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where he drove that ball, where he's bitching about it, Aaron Hills, he's in the lake at TPC at Sawgrass, and no one says a word. Well, he's just in the lake. Oh, that's okay. I'll just drop it out and play. So they're almost immune to water over there because it's so much of it. Yet they get a patch of long grass and they go crazy. Well, so, yeah. Whilst the rough was silly, it was too thick.
Yeah.
You know, they don't see the incongruity in their argument when they're playing tour events every week where there's a lake down the side of the 18th fairway.
Yeah.
And you miss the fairway by 5 yards and you're in the water, and that's okay.
And he got just duly pilloried yesterday by Adam Scott, by Rory McIlroy. Yeah. I'm not sure if you've got any of that.
Jeff's ready to go, but I'm sure he won't mind us just playing. We'll let Rory sort of sum up the thoughts of a few of those players. This is what McIlroy had to say in response to the point that Kevin Na was trying to make.
We have 60 yards from left line to right line. Like, you've got 156 of the best players in the world here. If we can't hit it within that avenue, you may as well pack your bags and go home. Like, I don't get... These are the widest fairways we've ever played in a US Open. And even the first and second cut, it's another 10 yards on top of that. I don't know. It's the US Open. It's supposed to be a tough test.
So there's Rory McIlroy. Thoughts on that before we say goodbye to the former winner of this championship?
Well, he was very critical when he fell out of contention at Chambers Bay a couple of years ago of the setup there. So he's not afraid to pot the USGA, Rory McIlroy, at all, even though he's a past winner himself. So I think he summed up the thoughts of a lot of players. I know there are a couple of others who expressed the same sentiment. And, you know, if you're not afraid to be critical of the USGA and you come up with a pretty logical answer there that Rory McIlroy did, I think that says it all.
Well, a man who kept the ball in play and straight and got it up and down when he had to in 2006. Well, he won the US Open's been good enough to give us a bit of his time on the eve, certainly over here in Australia, of the next US Open. He won it at Wingfoot over a decade ago now, and he's been good enough to join us on Inside the Ropes. Of course, I speak of Jeff Ogilvie, and we say welcome to the show, Jeff. Thanks for your time.
G'day, guys. Thank you. No worries.
It's Andy Marr, Mike Hazen, a voice you know. Mark Hazen, a voice you know all that well. Mike, all too well. Mike Clayton, in the studio having a yak. From where you are at home, Jeff, have you been following the various bits of commentary back and forth about the setup of this course leading into the Open?
I really haven't, actually. I'm not on Twitter anymore, which I assume is where most of this stuff is going on. That and the Golf Channel over here. The Golf Channel's pretty... During the major weeks, they run almost 24-hour-a-day panels of, like, experts discussing the golf tournament. But I mean, I'm not completely immune. I saw Kevin Na's little video there. But I'm not really following it too much. I mean, it's par for the course for the US Open. I mean, the players, for whatever reason, could pick on all sorts of different... We have so many different, like, authoritative bodies in golf, but everyone seems to want to pick on the USGA. It's the professional golfer's favourite target. And they've opened themselves up for it a lot of times with some pretty bad setups and some pretty poor decisions along the way. But it's that season. It's pick on the USGA season, so I don't think too many people are paying too much attention. At least they won't once the tournament starts.
Jeff, only one of us on this panel will claim to be experts, and it's definitely not Andy and myself, so you're safe here. Mate, is it weird for you to be so detached from a US Open after it being such an integral part of your life for so long?
It is a bit of a weird one. It was a really difficult decision. You know, I've probably played about 15 in a row. I haven't counted it, but it's about that many. close, 12, 13 maybe. There was often players coming up, because I've been exempt all this time, and they'd be like, oh, I'm not going to play the qualifier. I'm going to focus on the tournaments after it. Like, it's just too hard. It's just, and I just never got that perspective. I never got it. It's like, why wouldn't you want to play the US Open? And then this year, I'm not exempt for the first time for a while, and it, after looking at the schedule and studying and kind of working out what my priorities are this year, I couldn't make it work either to even try to qualify. So it's just one of those, it's very strange. I mean, it's, as you said, it's been a part of my golfing kind of year every year for quite a long time. So it's a little different, but I'm having fun. I'm enjoying a week with the kids. I'm practicing really early in the morning in Arizona because it's hot and I'm getting ready to go on probably 7 or 8 tournaments out of the next 9 weeks. So I'm going to enjoy watching the golf this weekend.
So this is all about your push to, you know, get up into the top 125 and keep your card for the subsequent season. How's that? How do you feel like that's going? It seems like in times this year you've put forward some really good progress, and then at others probably you haven't endeared, you know, yourself more than anyone to what the brand of golf you're playing.
No, I mean, it's really close. I mean, I know a lot of guys will say that. I've been on a bit of a search with it, which will happen. We do this for so long. And I'm kind of, I don't know, 18 years in to being a pro, and that doesn't count the sort of 10 years before that where I was obsessed with golf and playing golf every day too. I mean, it's, you do it for so long that it just ebbs and flows, and I've just been on a bit of an ebb. But it feels like it's coming around. I'm slowly working myself out a little bit and what's good for me and what's not good for me, and looking forward to it. Yeah, I mean, obviously top 125 is the number one base kind of priority, but every little step up from that opens all the doors that used to be open to me. So, yeah, the goal is just get it worked out, make a few more putts, and get back in the mix in these big tournaments again.
So, Jeff, you've told us previously, I suppose, that, you know, you have one eye on coming home to Australia at some point before, you know, while you still can, and it sounds like you've still got the fire in the belly to keep plugging away over there for a little while longer yet. Has there been any decisions on your plans for the future?
You know what? It's always been the plan to come back to Australia. As the kids have grown up, we've got 3 kids now, and they're getting entrenched in school. It's it complicates the issue a little bit. And yeah, a couple of years ago, I was pretty over the golf thing. I mean, it had been, as I said, 15 or 16 years I'd lived outside of Australia mostly. And Plates will testify to this. Like, long stretches of not playing very well makes golf pretty miserable, you know. It only takes one week to make it all happy and exciting again. And, so that's kind of what you're going for. But at this point, I mean, I'd love to live at home. But at the moment, this is home, and as you said, I'm pretty revved up and looking for a second or third wind or whatever you want to call it at this point. There's still a lot of golf in me. So at this point, not in the short term, but in the long term, that's the plan.
Which kind of begs the question that was your 40th birthday this week. So
happy birthday.
Yes. I remember David Graham and Peter Thomson were 40, and I thought they were so old. And it seemed like their careers were kind of over, but... You know, as we were joking on the phone the other day, 40 is the new 30. And, you know, it always seemed like some guys had games that would endure for a long time. Sam Snead, long swings, languid swings like yours. And other guys were kind of, so the short, quick swingers were done in their mid to late 30s. So, I mean, I look at your game and feel like it can go for a while yet. So, but, I mean, 40 is a number. And I know when I was 40, I was done. I'd had enough. But it seems like there's plenty more good golf left if you want to do it. You know, which I guess is that...
I think so.
Yeah, you know, it's what it comes down to is if you want to do it, doesn't it? Seems like.
I think so, mostly. I mean, the beauty about golf is... I mean, it's an athletic endeavour, but it's also a pretty psychological or mental endeavour. So, as when you begin, I guess, or when you get out on tour in your early 20s, physically... you beat everyone out there because you did 21 or 22 or 23. And gradually as you go, at some point, like, the experience and the physical thing is, it lines up and that guy's peak. But as your physical stuff drops off and you have the aches and pains and your back maybe aches a little bit, and physically you can't hit it as far, you're constantly gaining in experience and kind of mental abilities. So I think, and which is really probably the more important thing in golf at the end of the day. It was pretty well illustrated at the Masters this year. All year they've been talking about it's the young 20-somethings, the older guys have got no chance. They hit it too far. They're just too much. They're just better golfers. The Justin Thomases and the Jordan Spieths and these guys. But then you get to the Masters with nine holes to play. It's Sergio and Justin Rose, who are both late 30s and been at it for a really long time. So when it comes down to it, I think experience and a lot of golf tournaments under your belt is always going to be more important, or as important or more important than the young strength of a young 20-something. So I think, exactly to your point, I think there's no reason why a guy in their 40s can't be the best golfer in the world. I just can't see it. I mean, Stenson's done it the last couple of years. As I said, Sergio and Justin Rose and Scotty and that. I mean, they're all pretty late 30s now too. So, and they're really the ones you look at towards the end of the tournament, who are the ones who are doing well at the big stuff. So I feel good about it. I mean, my body feels great. It doesn't hurt like I think other 40-year-old golfers hurt. And I like golf more now than I ever have, which I think is really, which is really probably the, I mean, I might not necessarily love playing tour events in the rain for 4 days, 3 weeks in a row and stuff like that, but as a game, it consumes as much of my thought as it ever has. So, yeah, it's in a good spot.
Speaking of 40-year-olds, can anyone answer the question why they couldn't move Phil Mickelson's daughter's graduation a day forward? Like, is it that big a deal?
That's an it. Over here, high school graduation is a really big deal. Everything is, right? I mean, they make everything bigger. They have a football game and they call it the World Championship. everything is just bigger and better. And it's just one of those things. And he's always been 100% consistent on not missing his kids' stuff. I mean, I think there's been a couple of other US Opens, right, where he's had other school stuff go on and he's flown home on Tuesday night and flown back in on Wednesday night for the tournament, stuff like that. I mean, it seems to happen to him every year at the US Open. You would think a little bit of planning, you could have had the graduation a couple of days earlier and then their favourite son could have gone and played the US Open. But that's the way it is over here, I guess.
Jeff, back to your passion for the game for a second. We had Nick Flanagan on last week and he was talking about how he's found the love for the game again in playing with his mates, specifically around San Antonio. I've heard you talk before about, you know, even when you go on a pre-British Open trip, you know, you might go and play at Western Gales or Prestwick or somewhere, you know, just with a group of mates in the lead up to it. And I understand you probably still play those little money games in Arizona too. There, you still have that sort of flair in the belly to just get out and whack balls and have fun with your mates, just like we would as a chopper at Ker Lewis, wouldn't you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that's really probably where my just my desire or love for it ever kind of dropped off a little bit, was when I headed to the driving range and just hit balls. Growing up, I was never a ball hitter. I would hit balls on the range or the practice fairway only if the course wasn't available. Like, it was a last resort for me. I just wanted to play holes, and I just played holes all day. And if I wasn't playing holes, it was a putting contest. It was putting around with one ball, trying to shoot a low score for the lap around the green, and then doing it again. And I stopped doing that at some point, 8 or 9 years ago, I guess. And I thought, well, I'm a professional golfer. I really should hit more balls than I do. And I started hitting more balls and more balls and more balls. And that, while it's very addictive, and it can be good for you in some ways because you learn a bit about your golf swing and stuff, it's not conducive to loving the sport. Very rare is the guy out there who's a real ball beater who seems happy on the golf course. I mean, when was the last time you saw Vijay look happy on the golf course?
1986.
I think Hogan had it worked out. I think Lee Trevino was a fair ball beater, and he seemed to work it out. But generally, the less I've done that the last sort of year, and the more I've just gone up and played those money games or just played by myself and played holes, play with friends, like make it competitive, I've found that my passion for the game is in the competition side of things as much as anything. And you just go down rabbit hole after rabbit hole when you hit balls on the range, and you end up forgetting that it's all just about getting a ball in the hole and having a good time.
Mate, can you just let us in on some funny, quirky little story about one of the money games you guys play there in Arizona? They're sort of famous among a lot of people without really knowing exactly why, if that makes sense.
Well, Whisperock, this club we're members at in Scottsdale in Arizona, there's probably, I want to say, 15 tour guys, like full tour guys, members there. Kevin Chappell, Ches Reavy, Phil Mickelson, Badge is a member there, Kevin Stadler, I'm forgetting. And then there's older guys like Gary McCord's a member there, Peter Costas is a member there, and there's a whole bunch of web.com players there, and there's a group of club golfers there, just guys who don't seem to have jobs that keep them at the office very much. There's about 30 or 40 or 50 guys there that can all break par every time they go play. And they're very competitive, and it's all about the money. So there's never big money, but it'll be that old $20 Nassau game, the American, 20 front, 20 back, 20 total. But they'll put automatic presses in there. So every time you're two down, a new match starts. So you win the first two holes, there's two matches going. The other guy wins them back off you. Now there's three matches going. So it gets from 20 to 60 pretty quick, and you might have those games going with three other guys in your group. So you might have three matches going all like that. So it can get pretty ugly. Usually it ends up pretty even when you have multiple games going and stuff. And it's fun. You get to the last few holes, and you've got a few shots that really matter, and you just doesn't matter how little the money is. You don't want to lose to your buddies. So it creates a little bit of what is hard to create on your own. There's a little bit of pressure and a little bit of like your heart rate go up a little bit. No, this is $150. I'm not going to give it to him. I have to make this putt, you know. So it's really a part of the culture at Whisperock. It's kind of a thing that doesn't really exist as much in Australia. I know there's plenty of guys on the weekend might play for a System 7 or $20 or the first round of drinks or whatever, but for a country that gambling is illegal, like the US, nobody plays golf here without playing for a little bit of money. And it's actually really good for your game. It's fun.
Yeah, they get to exercise their vices. That's the chance they get to do that. I don't want to be the golf nerd here who takes it back to 2006, Jeff, and I'm sure you're probably sick and tired of talking about it, but you know, Mickelson's name has been mentioned a couple of times on the way through. Ever since, you know, that fateful day, and we know his tortured kind of relationship with the US Open, it was probably as tortured as it ever was on 18 that particular afternoon. Have you ever sort of had a chat to him about, you know, what he did on 18 and what he was thinking? And has he ever kind of opened up to you about that?
No, I mean, we had a few chats about it pretty soon after it. Him just making sure don't feel guilty, it's nothing to do with you, and right. I messed it up. All that, I mean, being really good about it, being really gracious, and we never really, I mean, I don't think, does he really even know what he was thinking at that time? I've talked to Bones a lot, because I used to live next door to Bones, Phil's longtime caddy, and Bones has got hundreds of amazingly cool stories about him not being able to talk Phil out of doing something on the golf course, and how subtly has to be in his, like, massaging the ego, has to kind of make Phil think he's being silly when he lays it up, if that makes sense. You know, trying to talk him out of hitting the crazy shots. He's very, very difficult, and he's pretty skilled at it, Bones. We talked about it a few times, but when Phil gets in that mindset, you can't stop him. Like, if he drove it to the left, obviously, on the 18th at Wingfoot, and he decided he was going to hit it on the green and make one of, like, history's great pars on the 18th at US Open, and that's the way he thinks. He wouldn't have been thinking about consequences. He was just thinking about what he was going to do, which is probably why, more often than not, when he has a chance to win a tournament, he does. He's not afraid. He doesn't back down. Like, you remember the shot he hit at the Masters a few years ago, whatever year that was, Clay, like 4 years ago, whatever?
Yeah, I mean...
He was standing from behind the behind the tree on 13. It was a completely stupid shot. He could have chipped it out. He's the best wedge player in the world. He would have had less than 10 feet for birdie, or less than 15 feet. It would have been fine, and he was already leading by one or two. But Bones came home that night or the next day and said, Phil is 100% convinced that the guy who wins a golf tournament always hits a historic, amazing shot. And if he hits it, if he tries to hit it and pulls it off, he's going to win. And if he tries to hit it and doesn't pull it off, then it wasn't his week anyway. Hmm. That's truly how his mind works. So he's probably won a lot more tournaments than maybe he shouldn't have because of that. But there's collateral damage. You're going to lose an odd one along the way. And I guess the US Open, this particularly my US Open, was a pretty obvious example of that. But his thinking isn't, it isn't as cavalier as you might think. He just thinks, well, if I'm going to win, I'm going to win. So I might as well just do it how I want to do it.
Jeff, was Monty as graceful?
You know, I didn't see Monty. It's quite a funny story that day, actually. Apparently, he nearly got arrested. Well, I don't know if you've heard this story, Clay, but behind the 18th green that day, he makes double on the last, obviously coming off in a hump, like all...
Yeah, what a surprise, yeah.
Puffing and breathing and, like, palms facing backwards and, like, yeah, like the whole march into the scorer's hat. And I guess he bumped into a policeman with his head down. And I guess the policeman, like, said, oh, well, watch where you're going. And Monty flared up at him, apparently, before he realised it was a policeman. And apparently they were very, very close to getting him in handcuffs that night, that afternoon. So he was great about it later on. But at the time, it probably wasn't the great time to talk to Monty.
So you talk about, like, Phil's, you know, belief that there's a shot that gets played that, you know, lingers in the history of time, you know, to underscore the triumph. That would be your chip on 17, wouldn't it? I mean, and if my memory serves me correctly, you won't know this, Jeff, because you were playing at the time, but it's a long time ago, but I reckon whoever the broadcaster was probably Channel 9 back in the day. I reckon they were in an ad break when my memory is that they were in an ad break when in real time you knocked that in. And it was one of those moments that they came out of the ad break and it was like, while all that was going on, Jeff Ogilvie had this on 17 and you knew they were playing it off, you know, if you know a bit about TV, you knew they were rolling in it off tape.
Uh-huh.
And the way they were sort of throwing to it, you kind of, there's no Twitter, so you didn't know what had happened. You knew something was going to happen. So it was, they kind of gave it away a little bit. Was that your shot? Was that shot that'll, you know, live forever?
Probably. Look, the shot on 18, my pitch shot on 18 was better. Yeah. It was a better shot because it was a much harder shot and it was a better shot. And that's the one I will remember. But the one before it, the one that went in on 17, that, if it doesn't go in, it goes across the other side of the green. It was in or it was down in three. There was no down in two there, you know, well, that sort of thing. And yeah, it was going 15, 12, 15 feet past because that's the way the green was. So I guess you'd say that was more important. That was a more important shot to chip in, but the shot at 18 was a better shot. So that's what I'll run with.
So you talk about the pitch on 18. The approach on 18, I know when as soon as the ball left Monty's club face, he knew he'd hit a bad shot on 18, that kind of short, weak, right shot that he could play under pressure. When you hit your shot in, it was from about 140, I can't remember exactly, but when you hit that shot, did you think you'd hit the perfect approach?
I did, actually. I mean, we had to wait on the tee for a really long time. So I chip in and we walk to the 18th tee, which is right next to the 17th green, which Phil's just hit it on. So it's pandemonium. Like this, and we're standing there for about 5 or 6 minutes. Someone was messed, Harrington or Furyk or someone in the group in front of Monty messed up 18 completely, took forever. So Monty was standing there with his club in his hand on the fairway, kind of swinging it in his hands, just kind of impatiently waiting. And then obviously the green clears, he hits his shot. And Monty's, he's very easy to read when he's grumpy, but he kind of looks grumpy all the time.
Right.
So he hits his second shot into the 18th, and he just puts his head down and kind of marches towards the green. Well, he could have hit it to 4 feet and done that, because he reacts like that all the time. So we didn't think anything of it. I hit a great tee shot up 18, really hard fairway to hit. Had the best drive I hit all week, by far. Like, I hit it really hard, hit a long way. I only had a 9-iron in, but it was in a divot, like a sandy
That's
divot.
That's right.
which was pretty disappointing after you've just hit the drive that you've waited your whole life to hit and you end up with a sandy divot. But it wasn't a bad one, but it was enough to... I had a pretty good second shot, but it was enough. It's one grain of sand or 2 grains of sand gets between the face and the ball, and it takes 4 or 5 yards off it and comes back. But in the air, both Squirrel and I thought it was going stiff. It was going straight at it, and it would have finished somewhere near where my pitch finished if it had gone another 4 yards. You know?
It was so awesome. And then you make that...
I was happy with my shot. And then I got it up and down for par, but I didn't know Monty had made 6 until we got to the green. Like, we saw him, I think, roll a putt up and then tap it in, but we just assumed that was for a 5, at worst. And it wasn't until the scoreboard was kind of tucked around the corner and you couldn't really see it till you walked onto the green surface, and it wasn't until then that I realised that there was only one guy in front of me at that point, and that was Phil. Because up till that point, I mean, I'd been in front and behind all day. It was one of those days, but I'd been behind for the last 4 or 5 holes, and the next leaderboard I saw from 14, I was 2 behind, and then I get to the 18th green, all of a sudden it's only Phil and he's only 1 in front. That's kind of really how it worked. I didn't really know what was going on until that point exactly. Yeah, and then Phil did what he did, yeah.
There's this amazing, it's a beautiful moment. I don't know whether you've watched it or whether your wife Julie's watched it or not, but I was telling Clates before, when we knew you were coming in, I went back and had a look at some YouTube clips of, your US Open. And there's that moment when, you know, you signed your card and you're in the locker room and, you know, the obligatory media has got cameras trained on you because, you know, your moment might come in that environment. And Phil gets plugged in the bunker on to the left of 18 and he plays that impossible bunker shot and the run through the green. And he's played 5, and you know everything is now becoming obvious that you're going to be the US Open champion. And they cut away to you in the room, and Julie was heavily pregnant at the time, and she was sitting down, and you were standing up behind her, and she had this look on her face that, oh God, I think we've just won the US Open. And it's this priceless, magnificent look of somebody who wants to be full of elation and joy, but it's not over yet. I mean, you know, Mickelson could have chipped it in, forced a playoff, but... have you seen that vision? Do you know the moment that I'm talking about?
I've got the DVDs. The NBC or someone over here gave me like the copy of the tournament. So I've got the DVDs, which I've watched once or twice, I think, but not for quite a long time. And I remember the footage you were talking about. I must have seen at that time, but we haven't looked at any.
Right.
Since.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty surreal because it was kind of, I kind of knew I was going to win, I guess, signing the card, which was when Phil hit his second shot into the tree and then hit that third one, and I think it plugged in the back left bunker. So he had to get it up and down out of a plug line, a bunker, just for a playoff at that point. And that was all the scorers had. I saw all that happen. And had a nice little moment with Ian Poulter, who was my playing partner. We'd been mates for a while. He was nothing but happy for me, and he was pumped. It was just a really cool thing, and they kicked us out of there because Phil was going to be coming there at some point. So it was a 5-yard walk across the little breezeway into the locker room, and then all that happened. So I kind of had a pretty good idea before I even got in there that I was about to win, but you still don't believe. I mean, that's the best part about sport, right? That's why we watch sport for moments like that. I mean, it's just...
Exactly.
It's just... like, you get that shield of... I mean, athletes put up that front or that personality that they sell to the public. But in moments like that, that all goes away, you know. Sergio this year at the Masters was like that. And even I don't know if you remember, when Tiger chipped in on 16 against DeMarco, when he chipped it up the hill and it came back in, and he had that little weird moment with Steve Williams, and his look on his face, it was just like that. That was one of the only times we've ever seen the real Tiger Woods, I think, because it was so amazing that the shield got dropped down. But yeah, I can believe that it was a cool moment on TV because it was a pretty cool moment to be there doing.
It was. Hey, does it? This might be a really hackneyed question, but does it change your life? Like, you win one of these things, does it have that kind of profound impact on, you know, your life thereafter?
Yes and no. I don't know where my life would have gone after 2006 at Wingfoot if I hadn't won it. I feel like it would have gone a similar direction. but it definitely changes. It changes people's perspective of you as a golfer. You get a level of respect that's whether warranted or not. I mean, it's just another four-round tournament, and I mean they're difficult to win, surely, but people are different around you for a long time. Especially the U.S. Open in America. I'm sure it's the same with the Open Championship in the U.K. And, people are just different. People are just a little bit different around you. And obviously the financial opportunities are amazing for the next... That probably lasts amazing for the next 12 months and then really good for about 5 or 6 years after that. So that aspect of it was pretty changing. I mean, I was making a nice amount of money beforehand, but that was crazy money. Like, just... of what people will pay you to just turn up to their thing and do nothing almost. It's kind of ridiculous, really. I found it kind of a bit embarrassing sometimes.
Right. No, just take it. You're all right.
Absolutely.
How much was Andrew Robb making from the Chinese?
I got over the embarrassment.
So if...
It's crazy how people treat you. I didn't feel any different. I just felt like I was a golfer. It made me want to win them more than I had before, actually, weirdly enough. After it, I wanted to win majors more than I did want to win them before I won that, if that makes sense. Maybe because I'd proved that I could, you know, and I worked out how much fun it is to do.
Is it harder to win the first one, or is it harder to win a second one?
Well, I would say it's harder to win the second one.
Yes. Yes.
From personal experience. Clayton would probably say it's harder to win the first one.
Yeah, I would. Well, they're all hard. I mean, they're all hard to win. I mean, there are no rules to winning.
Look,
I mean,
about giving it. You know. No. I mean, opportunity.
I mean, generally, guys like a guy like Grades, who was a good player, but that was all. He was a really good player. He wasn't anywhere near as talented as Jeff is in terms of hitting shots. Mm. But a guy like Grades normally gets one go at it, and if they screw it up, that's it. They're done. And he came back, and that was one of the most impressive things I ever saw, was that he could back that up and go and win one after losing one. Because normally those guys, like Vandervelde's a classic example. I mean, there are hundreds of them. Doug Sanders. Once they lose that heartbreaker, they're done.
Len Mariachi.
Yeah.
Len Matisse,
yeah. So it's, there are no rules as to, look at Sam Snead. The guy never won a US Open. He was arguably one of the greatest five players ever and never won the US Open. So
Jeff, going back to getting away from the majors, I suppose, a little bit, but going back to the respect that this thing has offered you over the 10 years subsequent, I believe you went to Liberty National recently and you're taking up a new role with the President's Cup team this year, which has been dear to your heart for a long time now, but that's the sort of thing that these opportunities have afforded you, hasn't it, to be a vice-captain and working alongside Nick Price and trying to bring the Americans down?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be fun. I mean, it's already fun, and we haven't really done anything yet. But it's probably my favourite event to play in golf. I mean, I think the Open Championship and the Masters are probably like the best events, you know. But and the Ryder Cup, I'm not involved in that. That must be incredible. But to play in, like you hear it in sport 1,000 times a day. Like, the team environment's just amazing and it's great. But it really is true. Like, it's just getting to play with countrymen and us, we get some, obviously it's basically the Southern Hemisphere effectively and Asia against the US. It's incredible and it's just great. I mean, I played with Gary Player. My first captain was Gary Player. I mean, I just got to spend a week in close contact with Gary Player, which was just amazing, right? I mean, just that alone was great. And then I had Norman a couple of times and that was just incredible. And now I'm going to be on the other side of it with, Nick Price driving the cart and delivering the sandwiches. I'll get one of those earpieces in my ear and I'll look all important. Scotty just made a 3-footer on 16. Let's watch Jason doing that sort of stuff. I can't even imagine, but it's going to be a great opportunity. And Pricey's a 10 out of 10 human being. I mean, he's just incredibly good. So, great fun to hang around, and he's got Tony Johnston,
who's 11 out of 10.
He's the funniest man in the world.
He's the funniest. He's a classic, Ovies. But people say there are no characters left in golf, but of course they don't. They're only looking at the top 10 players, like Tony Johnson and Simon Obday. No funnier man ever.
I listen to his commentary and follow him on Twitter. Just, I don't know him, but I love that man. He's hilarious.
He's the funniest bloke. Yeah. I mean, just...
You'd be able to pull a few strings, Jeff, and get these guys on the podcast with us.
I don't know. Clayton could get Ovies on.
I can get Ovies on. He's easy to get on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He'd be on. He's on. Yeah.
Mate, we'll let you... you're going.
Yeah, it'd be great. I mean, if it's... Place is right. There's characters all over the place. It's just they're not the top 20 players in the world, so no one notices them.
Hey, we'll let you go.
It's helping with that, and social media is helping with that.
It is. It is. I think golf could actually be one of the real big beneficiaries of this changing media environment. I mean, if it... You know what it's like over here, Jeff. It doesn't have the status, you know, and kind of frontline commercial media that it used to have when you certainly started playing professional golf. It kind of doesn't have that luster anymore. But through things like, you know, this kind of podcast and in the many and varied media streams that are available now, it can certainly own that space. And, you know, there are personalities out there to shine through. There's hundreds of thousands of people out there ready to consume what they've got to offer.
I think so. I mean, it's for whatever reason I've found in my journey, just to finish it, that people are very interested in what professional golfers have to say, and I don't understand why.
Right.
But they are.
Well, some of you are quite thoughtful and interesting to listen to. Not all of you, but some, present company included, are quite interesting and worth having a listen to. Mate, can we finish it where we started? Just before we do let you go, you've played in all the majors, so you know you've got intimate knowledge of the way they're set up and the way they kind of treat the players and you know all of that sort of stuff. Do you like the personality of the US Open, the courses that they produce, and what it asks specifically of players as opposed to the other majors?
I like the personality of playing the tournament. The scale of the tournament is so huge that it really, in some respects, it's the biggest tournament in the world just on the size and the scale of the event when you're there, which is not surprising. As I said, when they're in the US, they seem to do things pretty big. But as far as the course, I think sometimes they kind of get pretty close to right, but I think usually they distort the setup a lot just to try to get us near par. And at Oakmont, you don't have to do anything to Oakmont and we'll still just be near par. And at some other courses, you need to distort the hell out of it just to get us to shoot the score they want. And I think sometimes that mentality gets them to miss the mark by a lot and make the courses not that fun to play. But sometimes they get it right. I mean, sometimes they do. Torrey Pines was a great setup and the best golfer in the world won. I think Pebble's always usually a pretty good setup for Pebble. Pinehurst was a great setup a couple of years ago. It was great fun to play. So, I mean, they get a few right, but I think their obsession with getting us to shoot par or over par causes them to just go a little bit over the top on certain courses that you really need to distort to get us to shoot scores like that, especially with the equipment and stuff we use now. So I'd say sometimes I love playing it, the course, generally not so much. But as far as a big event and the scale of it, it's a brilliant place to be. Like, the first tee of the US Open is amazing.
I bet it is. Mate, you've been really generous with your time. We really appreciate you giving it up for us here on Inside the Ropes, and hopefully we'll catch up with you again sometime. Thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks, boys.
Thanks, mate. Jeff.
The Golf Australia website is now the place to go to look up your handicap and so much more. Whether you're out and about on your phone or in the office trying to avoid work, just go to golf.org.au and punch your golf link number into the box at the top of the homepage. Who knows? Maybe that last round was just good enough to put you in single figures. While you're on the site, check out the daily golf results at your club, view our course index for up-to-date ratings, read the latest golf news from home and abroad, listen to Australian golf podcasts and interviews, and watch video tournament highlights or tips to improve your game. It's everything a golf tragic could want. Visit golf.org.au today, the home of Australian golf. Walking the fairways and the greens with the Aussie stars at home and away. Golf Australia's Inside the Ropes.
Fantastic having access to Jeff Ogilvie. That's the sort of stuff that you'll get on Inside the Ropes. Mark Hayes doing it, and Mike Clayton, of course, doing all the heavy lifting. Just remind the lot of you out there to subscribe to the program on iTunes, Google Play now for Android users, which is fantastic, or Stitcher. We've got a whole lot of... We tripled the audience size last week, Hazy. I don't know whether you're aware of that. That's the Martin Blake factor.
It was. It's an amazing... The you know, the pull he has, particularly in the Wimmera.
Well, I was going to... In the Wimmera, I thought I was going to say heavily skewed towards women. There was a huge audience draw amongst the female golf fans out there once they realised that Blakey was on the show last week. We got a whole lot of reviews, Mike, last week, which is apparently a thing that happens on iTunes reviews. 5-star reviews, which is like the maximum you can get from... And we said last week, Hazy, we'll mention... If anyone writes a 5-star review, we'll mention their names.
We've got a few to mention, unfortunately.
Strone33, Minkle Mike, Aussie Golf Reviewer, Terence Trent D'Arby is listening, which is outstanding.
Did he lip-sync that?
TJ85, Mega Trimmer. I don't know what he does.
I don't know Mega Trimmer. He's a legend. He fixed a seat in my car last week.
Mega Trimmer sounds
like... He's a legend. He's an absolute legend.
He either works...
The judge.
Did he work on a golf course?
Member around Furley.
There you go. Mega Trimmer and Matt Housted. So you know Mega Trimmer.
Absolutely.
That is magnificent.
He's a legend. He's in the committee at Round Furley.
There's a phrase I never thought I'd hear today, Andy.
We're not far away from hearing from Mark Leishman, and this is a pre-recorded interview that's happened over in the States by one of the great friends of the podcast and pretty much a part of the podcast, really.
He is. We're referring to Ben Everill, who was with the Australian Associated Press for a long time and was a real source of US Tour info for all of us, whether you knew it or not. He's since moved to the US PGA Tour and is working for them now. So it's great to have an Australian insider at that part of the world that we don't have regular access to. And Benny's very kindly told us that he'll be part of the team whenever he can here on Inside the Ropes. And he's managed to get hold of Mark Leishman on Tournament Eve for us, and we're really delighted that he's done that, and we're grateful, and we hope to hear a lot more of Ben's work with the players from Inside the Ropes.
So we'll play that to you in a moment, but just a couple of things before we get too far away from what Ogilvy was saying and the US Open in particular, Clates. You mentioned that he's turned 40 and he's got the kind of swing that will linger, that won't necessarily run out of... kind of go past its use by date because of his birth date. What do you mean by that? What sort of swing are you talking about?
Long, kind of languid, good rhythm. His body's. I mean, he doesn't look any different than he did when he was 20. Yeah, a bit like Bob Charles, who is the same weight at 80 as he was at 20. I'm sure because he's never eaten a bar of chocolate or a block of chocolate. Not once. Bob Charles, the most disciplined eater in the world.
I can't believe he's never tried chocolate. That's crazy.
But I'm sure he's tried it. He didn't inhale.
But
I mean, Jeff's got a great body for golf. He's thin and tall and flexible and long swing, good rhythm.
Like Sendo a little bit?
Yeah, same. I mean, Sendo's mid-40s and he's still flying. I mean, he's tremendous player.
So what about the challenges in terms of distance? And we know what Erin Hills has done in terms of stretching the course out. And, you're a course designer, so you know about this sort of stuff intimately. Is he still going to hit the ball far enough? I mean, those kind of basic metrics that you need to compete.
He hits the ball, I think, if I haven't looked at the stats for a while, but my guess is his driving distance is the same as it was 10 years ago when he was in the top 10 on the tour. Now he's probably 100th. At 290 yards or something. So whilst he hits the ball the same length as he did 15 years ago, he's lost out to Justin Thomas and the guys who just can absolutely smash it forever. But you can still compete driving at 300 yards, or you'd like to think so, which is, of course, the mess the game's in. The guys who, if you can't hit it a long way, you can't compete anymore. And golf was a better game than that because it allowed... When the equipment was better regulated, it allowed players who played lots of different sorts of games to compete. But now if you don't have great power, you can't compete.
Jason Day's taken out the 3-wood out of his bag at Erin Hills this week, Andy. He's dumped the 3-wood in favour of a strong 2-iron, which is sort of set up like a 1.5-iron almost. He's flying at 265 to 270, and he's hoping that it runs out to 300 yards. That's the thing that Clates is talking about here, that's knocked Jeff down the stats. And it shows you why the top echelon are where they are.
But Jeff grew up in the generation, obviously, after he's 20 years old, younger than me. We just grew up trying to hit the ball straight with a wooden driver and a ballada ball.
Yep.
But Jeff grew up right on the cusp of when wood went to metal, so he would have played with both. But the early metal woods were quite small and difficult to hit. I actually thought they were terrible clubs. But once they got the you know, the big size head. Then you know, the young kids now, that's all they've known, is a decent sized metal driver with a rock, the ball, which is essentially a pinnacle that will spin. And they've just, all they've known is hitting as hard and as far as they can.
So the short par four, can it survive? Can a you know, the 320 meter yard and under par four, is there any place for it in the modern game?
I think arguably they're more dangerous than they used to be. I mean, a hole like the 10th at Royal Melbourne and the 15th at Victoria, 3rd at Kingston Heath, 3rd
at short hole at Riviera,
3rd at Royal Adelaide, 10th at Riviera. I mean, arguably those holes are more dangerous now because you can reach them. You know, in the old days when 10th at Riviera, the field would basically play off the tee with a 4-iron over the first bunker and hit an 80-yard wedge to the green. Now they can get it on the green. Like, and the same at 10 at Royal Melbourne. It's the same temptation. Well, now I can get it on, so now you want to go for it. And it's a much more dangerous shot. I mean, if you pull it off, fine, but I mean, the 10th at Riviera and the 10th at Royal Melbourne are almost impossible to hit those greens. And they're brutal around them.
So
I think there's more of a place for those holes now than ever.
So last one on the US Open. We played what Kevin Na had to say before, and there was a reaction to that from some of the players. The day after, the USGA goes out and starts hacking a whole lot of the fescue off the sides of fairways. Those four holes, they just started to cut it back. They say that wasn't a reaction to player concern. They say it was a reaction to fescue laying down in heavy wind and, and heavy rain, which is forecast. Which side of the equation do you believe?
Oh, no, they're not going to listen to the players. I mean, Kevin Na bitching is not going to change their mind. I mean,
would a lot of other players, you know, players, would a lot of other players have been saying stuff away from microphones?
I don't know. I mean, that patch that Kevin Na found looked like it was a patch that had got a whole bunch of irrigation water on it. It was thicker than the stuff around it. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're guessing at their motivation, but you would think if you were going to hack the fescue down, they would have figured that out 2 weeks ago.
They are on notice, Andy. They've pushed it to the edge a couple of times, and it's nearly backfired on them. I think they're under the gun, to be honest. Rightly or wrongly. I mean, you know, they have 1 week to do it. But they've been setting these courses up for years, not just in the past 52 weeks. The setup that goes into Erin Hills is born of 6 or 7 years.
And, you know, the setups, it goes back to the ball. I mean, you know, the course is 8,000 yards long. It's, you know, so, you know, the whole thing, not that they'll necessarily play it at 8,000 yards, but they can if they want to. So everything's a reaction to the ball, really, and the ball going too far. But the USGA have always, my argument is they've always, Ben Hogan was the quintessential US Open player. He was the most precise player ever, probably. And Nicklaus was the other great US Open player. And he was pretty precise. He was more powerful, but not quite as precise. Well, no one was as precise as Hogan. So they've forever kept trying to find Ben Hogan, where there was only one. No one's going to play golf like Ben Hogan again. But they keep setting up courses to try and identify Ben Hogan when there isn't one. So you finish up with Andy North winning two of them. He was a good player, but that's all. Who would hit it in the rough, pitch it out, pitch it on, knock it in, and grind out 280 and win because he was a great grinder. You know, so they set a course to the traditional US Open course. They're setting up to find a player that doesn't exist. There only ever was one of them. Or Byron Nelson. Maybe there were two of them. But that was it. And that was 70 years ago.
I think Jeff's point was absolutely outstanding before when he's saying that, you know, their obsession with getting to a score is leading them to trick up courses way beyond their capacity. And I think that if I'd been that eloquent, Andy, last week, I might have won that argument with you and Gazelle, but I needed Jeff, apparently.
But you know, you look at the Open Championship, which has got an incredible list of winners. I mean, through the 70s and 80s, the best players in the world won that every single year. And it was about wind, bouncy ground, not high rough, short grass around the greens, difficult bunkers, and imagination. I mean, it's a much more interesting test than the US Open, which was just a test of hitting it straight, hit it between the lines. So anything that gets away from hitting it between the lines is a good thing. So that's why I think this week's a good thing, because it's, having not seen the course, it seems like it's pretty wide. Chambers Bay was interesting. It was a pity the greens were so bad there, because if the greens had been good, that would have got much better wraps. Pinehurst was tremendous. You know, wide fairways, no rough. You could putt the ball around the greens, which is one reason Keimer won, because he's not a great chipper, but he could putt it and get around. The putt was tremendous at Pinehurst.
Well, this place does look, the pictures look awesome. It does look like an awesome facility, and it'll be really interesting to see how it plays. There are five Aussies teeing it up. We mentioned the Ben Everill catch up with Mark Leishman. Let's hear from one of the Australians who goes in with justifiably high hopes.
Thanks, Mark, for joining us here on Inside the Ropes. Obviously, the lead up to the US Open on the eve of the big event. How are you feeling? How's your game feeling? Are you ready to rumble?
Feeling good, yeah, ready to go. Yeah, been playing well most of the year, and had a good tournament last week at Memorial. Drove it really well, which is good leading into a US Open. So, it's obviously a different course, but not your typical US Open course, which I'm pretty happy about. So, I had a good tournament last year at the US Open. Of all the US Open courses I've played, this is probably the one where I feel like I can contend the most. So that's pleasing going into a big tournament like this.
Definitely. I mean, you mentioned the driving. I know Dennis McDade was in at Memorial helping you sort of straighten those things out. You were 75% fairways, which was your best, I think, all year. You also had 75% when you won the Arnold Palmer. So you are bringing it in at the right time. Like you said, the fairways are wider than they have been in the past at a US Open. So that must just give you super confidence going forward.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, the fairways are wider, which is good. But if you're not driving it well, the long rough is brutal. You're probably going to lose your ball in there. If you do find it, you're probably hacking out sideways with a lob wedge, and you hope you get somewhere near the fairway. So it's gonna be tough. But yeah, it's a great event to be playing well leading into, and especially driving it well.
One of the things, we could probably hear it in the background here, we've got storms coming. We've had them early in the week. We've got another one tonight. We're going to have more during the week. How much do you think the weather's going to play a part? The wind, the rain, it's going to be a big part of this championship?
Yeah, it will be. Hopefully not too big a part. It would be nice if it firmed up a little bit and played a bit more like a British Open, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But, with the storms, I guess, comes wind and... hopefully we can have a bit of wind and to dry it back out again. And, it's probably going to take a little bit of luck just with, get the good side of the draw. And, you've got to play well and, more importantly, make those putts.
How have things changed for you this year, mate, after the win at the Arnold Palmer? I mean, obviously you had a tour win before that, but it had been a little bit of a break between drinks. Have you felt your game sort of go to that new level?
Yeah, I feel like it has. It's just nice to play the way I know I can play. I've had stretches since I've been on tour. This is my ninth year. I've had stretches where I've played well, but never really put a good 6 months or year together. And I feel like I'm doing that this year, just playing the way I know I can. And I guess I would like to have won more, but winning this year certainly gives you confidence, especially being one of the bigger events. And probably the next step now is to try and contend again, and then. Probably win a major, so hopefully that can happen. This week would be a nice time to do it, but if not, we've got the Open Championship at Birkdale, which I played well there before, and then the PGA Championship in Charlotte. So a lot of opportunities, but excited about this week.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you obviously contended heavily in majors, mate. You lost a player for the British Open. You've led late at the Masters and early at the Masters. It's something you're feeling comfortable with, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah. I try and not take it too serious. I feel like that's a way that, I deal with pressure or maybe not dealing with pressure. You don't create any pressure on yourself if you don't hype it up too much. So, I'm trying to treat it like a normal golf tournament. I have contended late in majors before. Hoping I can do that again soon, but... It's just nice to be regularly playing majors again. I think I've played all majors in at least the last couple of years, so that's been good.
Now, before we let you go, mate, your shoes, I've noticed some green laces and a couple of guys' names on each shoe. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, just raising some awareness for muscular dystrophy. A couple of lads back in Warrnambool, Aaron and Chris Gillen, they're struggling with muscular dystrophy. So, if we can just get some awareness out there about it, try and raise a little bit of money. The shoes I'm wearing this week, actually, I'm gonna sign, and hopefully the boys will sign it where their name is on the shoe, and then we can auction them off and raise some money. So it's expensive for them to deal with their illness, and you know, this gives them a bit of a buzz as well. Hopefully having, you know, having their names on the shoes and just getting some awareness, having the lime green laces and just create a bit of a talking point. So,
mate, you've always been good with this sort of thing. Obviously, your Begin Again Foundation is doing great as well. You had a good golf day recently with that?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, had a great day. Everyone really enjoyed it. Good party afterwards and raised a lot of money. So, you know, just great to be able to... It's great to be in a position to give back and then to actually do something about it and give back. So, we enjoy doing it, and it just, you know, really makes a difference in families' lives that we help. So it's, hopefully we can continue doing it and help a lot of families.
Well, mate, everyone at Inside the Ropes and everyone back in Australia is obviously very proud of you, and we're expecting good things and big things for you this week. Good luck and hopefully get that first major.
No worries. Thanks, Benny.
He's a good man. He knows where home is, I reckon, Mark Leishman. As far as he travels far and wide, obviously, and he's over there at the moment with his professional responsibilities, and who knows, you know, where he domiciles himself for the rest of his life. But I think he knows where he's from. He never loses sight of that.
Hey, he loves coming home whenever he gets a chance. Not often as he'd like, and that's true of most of our guys over there, I think. We've already heard from Jeff, who's definitely in that category, but definitely Felicia. And you can see that with his passion for those two young Warrnambool fellas. Mm. You know, that's a hard deal, hard road that they're facing. And, you know, it's great that he can remember that and offer a bit of support on a global stage. So if you get the chance, get behind those guys.
Anybody probably has, anybody to a degree probably has, but do you think that he really has an opportunity or the type of game to win a major championship? He's been sticking his nose in the frame for the last few years now, Mark Leishman. Do you see him winning one of these?
He had a really good chance to win the Masters that Adam won. He was hit in the water at 15 and made 6, and that kind of blew him out of that. And then he had a great chance to win the Open. I mean, he missed that 16 on the last day at St Andrews. He hit it in the bunker, hit it out to what, 6 foot, missed it. Got in the playoff and drove it in the divot at the, you know, and got shafted there on the first hole of the playoff, and Zach Johnson won. But yeah, I mean, clearly he can win a major. He's a terrific player, Leishman. And again, the same sort of Ogilvy, long, languid kind of swing. You know, he'll play well for a long time.
And conditions probably, you know, if it is going to be windy, if it's going to be as windy as they say it's going to be, I know we go, oh, if you're from Warrnambool, then you've got to be able to play in the wind. I'm sure there are some people down in Warrnambool who hate the wind, but he has shown a capacity to deal with it pretty well.
The tougher it gets, the better chance he'll be, and the less American-style conditions, he'll rise.
Hmm.
Yeah, the wind is, I mean, Warrnambool and Port Ferry, I mean, they're the two windiest places in the world, aren't they, Blake Golf?
We're going to talk to you a bit later on the about your favourite little hidden gems in Victoria. Yeah. Port Ferry amongst those?
Port Ferry is the best value golf in the... Well, Port Ferry and Arrowtown in New Zealand, Queenstown, New Zealand.
You told me to go and play there. I love that golf course.
They're the best value.
I love that. The golf course is so much fun.
You can go to the hills and pay, what is it, $500?
If you can get on.
And you can go to Arrowtown and pay $40, and Arrowtown's like, why would you have a hamburger when you can have a steak?
I mean, they make you feel welcome.
It's like playing $40 for the hamburger and $10 for the steak. I mean, come on. I mean, it's like,
crazy.
Arrowtown's amazing. That's a completely unique golf. There is nothing like that place in the world.
Not a bunker on the course.
No, it's incredible.
Not a bunker on the course. All these volcanic rock just sticks up out of the place. And if you ever go over to New Zealand, Hazy, you've got to take your clubs down to Arrowtown. It's great fun. It's really good.
Will do.
G'day, I'm My Golf Ambassador Jason Day. I'm really excited to be an ambassador for My Golf, Australian Golf's National Junior Program, jointly run by Golf Australia and the PGA. My Golf is every Aussie kid's first step on their golfing pathway. It's all about teaching children the basic skills of golf in a safe and healthy environment. And just as importantly, about the life skills that golf can teach you that distinguish our sport from the rest. Remember to visit mygolf.org.au for more information.
Walking the fairways and the greens with the Aussie stars at home and away. Golf Australia's Inside the Ropes.
So time to have a look at what you know, Australian players are doing around the world. We generally start with the kind of major tours around the place, Hazy, and Clates sort of jump in whenever you feel the need. But we're not going to do that today because we've got, you know, one of the brightest young lights in Australian golf who's getting closer to taking a pretty big step from, you know, a minor tour onto the secondary tour over in the States. We're talking about Ryan Ruffles, of course, who's still in a state of graceful mourning after Collingwood got knocked over by Melbourne on Queen's birthday over here. But he's got bigger fish to fry than that. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for joining us in Inside the Ropes.
Hey guys, good to talk to you, and yeah, it's nice to hear some banter about the footy again.
Well, there'll be plenty of that on the way through, I reckon, but we like focusing on what Australian players are doing around the world, and we know that you're mixing your time on the PGA Tour when you get the opportunity to play there, and the Latino Tour, which is one of the development tours over in that part of the world. You're very close now to making a pretty big step from where you are onto the next flight above you. Tell us exactly where you're at the moment.
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a whirlwind year so far. I got some opportunities early in the year, like you said, on the PGA Tour, and I've got some more coming up. But I've been able to use this Latin America tour a little bit too to my advantage. And pretty much, for those who don't know, the Latin America tour feeds into the Web.com tour, and obviously the Web.com tour feeds under the PGA tour. So for me, starting out my pro career a little bit, it's nice to have a schedule to play. I think they've got about 19 events on their schedule, and through the first 8 events, I've been able to play 4 now, and I'm sitting at 6th on that money list. So top 5 at the end of the year get a Web.com tour card, and that'd be a nice little thing to have going into next year.
So you're only a couple hundred bucks out of that slot now, Ryan, and I'm imagining that you hope that you don't have to worry about it if you make enough money on the US tour, the big tour. But how are you finding it down in Latin America? I know you speak beautiful Spanish, and we'd love to hear a bit of that, mate, if you don't mind. But you seem to be having a tremendous strike rate when you do go down there. Capped by the second place last week in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, I mean it's like you said, it's not exactly, obviously I want to play well in my PGA Tour starts, and then hopefully this becomes obsolete to where I'm trying to go. But for me, having this mixed in with my PGA Tour starts not only keeps me sharp for the starts that I do get, keeps me playing competitively, 4-round tournaments, but it also lets me, when I get into a PGA Tour event, have a bit of a free swing at it, because if I can lock up my web card down here, say this week or in the coming weeks, then I know as a minimum that I'm going to have web.com status the following year, which is better than what I've had this year. So it sort of just gives me a free swing at the starts that I do get out there, and hopefully because of that, be a bit more relaxed and play a bit better. And so it's a good opportunity, and I've been playing good. Like you said, I've had a couple second place finishes in a row, and I feel like I'm creeping up on that first win, which would be nice.
So we'll come back to the US Tour in a second, but you're calling us from a pretty obscure but beautiful place in the world, Montego Bay in Jamaica.
We were
going to sing, but Andy's barred us from actually...
We'll have to pay too much money if we play the music, and we can't sing, so...
So what's that like there, mate? You're sitting in a beautiful beachside place in Jamaica. Obviously, you're not there for the tourism, but it's great that you can join us from such a beautiful, remote place in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of one of the little luxuries of playing on this tour. And, yeah, I mean, the Latin America tour is not exactly what I wanted to be doing through my PGA Tour starts last year. But I was speaking to my parents and stuff earlier. There's some experiences that I get out here. I get to travel to some beautiful places down here in South America and the Caribbean and stuff that I would probably never travel to in my life if I didn't play this tour. So I've been able to travel to Jamaica. Costa Rica was one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to in my life. I've been to Ecuador, and I've been to Peru, and I've been to Argentina. Just some really cool experiences, getting to see some different cultures and stuff away from the golf course that have been quite a good experience as well. And I mean, I've always, when people ask me about this tour too, every one of these tournaments is that country's national open or national championship, and so they take a lot of pride in their event. And because of that, they host it as good as any other national open. They really do a lot because they're very proud of their event, and that's pretty special too, to be a part of that.
Are you traveling with people? Like, have you got, it's a long way from home, and Hazy said you speak the language, which helps. I mean, that obviously helps enormously, but it's still a long way from home. Have you got kind of people who are there with you every step of the way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I've got a caddy, Simon Clark, who's actually plays at Victoria Golf Club, but he's caddied on the US Tour for about 10 years, caddied for Jeff Ogilvy. I'm not sure if you've had him on already or if he will be on, but he has also caddied for Ishikawa the last 4 years, and he's given me a bit of a leap of faith, and he's got all the credentials to caddy for some of the best players in the world out on the U.S. Tour, and he's taken a leap of faith with me, and he's come down here, and he's going to every single one of these events with me, and going through the process of trying to eventually get my PGA Tour card. So that's pretty special to have someone in my corner like that who has opportunities elsewhere, but puts you first and really believes in my potential. And so it's nice. We travel a bit together. This week I've got my girlfriend with me too. So all those things help. Like, as you said, it's a long way from home and it's nice to have a bit of company, especially at 19.
I do want to ask you about your language, mate. Is that working out easily for you? I know you've grown up partially in the States and partially here where you don't really get to speak a lot of Spanish. Is it still fluent? Is it coming out of your mouth? Obviously, you don't have to worry about the senorinas with your beautiful girlfriend there, but is it working well for you?
Yeah, it's fluent. It's maybe not quite as good as my English, but it's not too far off. And you're right. When I came to Australia, I lost it a bit because I reckon you'd be able to count the number of people that speak Spanish in Australia on one hand. So you don't get to use it very much, but I pick it up pretty quick when I'm around so many people who speak and in countries that speak, and it definitely makes these trips a hell of a lot easier because there's no language barrier.
So for those who don't know, you learned it from your mum, right? Who was a Spanish speaker. Is that how it worked?
I learned it from mum's side. Mum's side of the family's South American.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a few people have said to me back in Australia, you know, people who just sort of don't know much about golf. So I know Ryan Ruffles is not doing that well. He's really struggling. And it's like when I was a kid, no one in the country, Peter Senior didn't. No one in the country made a state senior team until they were 20 or 21. This kid was 19, like.
Yeah, just turned 19. Played
great for 2 or 3 years. It's like people don't realize how hard it is out there for a 19-year-old kid to, 40 years ago, 19-year-old, that was a state junior team level. That was it. How much better, how much more advanced they are now because their techniques are better and they know so much more about what they're doing. Teachers are better.
Well, you said that yourself, Ryan, on the way through already today, that, this is kind of not, necessarily where you want to be, but it is part of the kind of learning curve and it's kind of where you have to be. That patience that you need to embrace and exhibit, are you getting better at just going, okay, I want it all now and I want to be, turning it up, on the PGA Tour now and I want to be playing at Erin Hills now. But are you getting better at just going, okay, it'll come. I'll just keep doing what I've got to do. Is that something that you're learning to be better at?
Yeah, 100%. I think it's so important. And I sort of had a pretty clear idea of that when I turned pro because I turned pro, like Clay said, even for nowadays, it was very young, but I thought I was ready and I don't regret it whatsoever. And there are a few people that maybe say this and say that. And yes, but like I've told Hazy a few times too, I was very close last year to getting a PGA Tour card. So it's been a lot of good golf lately, and it just maybe hasn't quite worked out the way I've wanted it to. But it's all a process. And like I've said in a number of interviews, whether I'm playing down the Latin America Tour or whether I get an opportunity on the PGA Tour, they're all opportunities. They all give you a chance to further your career. And say, you never know. I could play well the next 2 weeks where I've got some invites on the PGA Tour and this is done down here and I get out there and everything's perfect. But, if it did take me this season out here and it did take me next year on the Web.com Tour, I'd be on the PGA Tour at 21, which still would be very young for out there. And at 21, a lot of people would be saying that's a terrific achievement. And so I'm not too worried about rushing it. I just feel like it's all a process. And if I can learn to win out on the Latin America Tour and then learn to win on the Web.com Tour, that'll also put me in really good stead to try and win on the PGA Tour.
So for those who don't know, Ryan Gibson rolled in a putt late in a otherwise meaningless Sunday afternoon last year. One putt cost Ryan a spot in the Web.com Tour playoff. So it was extremely close. Mm. Ryan, you just further to the you're turning 19. I think you turned 19 around the weekend of the Zurich Classic, if memory serves. But that really opened up a lot of people's eyes, didn't it? Because had you won, you're in a position there with Kyle Stanley to compete and contend in that tournament. You would have been the youngest winner ever on the US PGA Tour. Did that sort of reinforce to people that the age you're at, that you are very tender in terms of experience, but it said to people, back off a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit, I guess. I mean, you do feel a little bit that way, and every now and again. But like I said, I'm not too fussed. I've never have been too fussed about what other people think about where I'm going. I've got a pretty good support system around me, and I trust everyone in there. And I feel like normally I have some fairly good common sense too about making decisions. So, I'm pretty confident in where everything's going. But it's nice every now and again to put up a result and sort of show people that, hey, I'm still here, I'm still kicking on, and I'm still playing some good golf. And I didn't quite eventuate there the way I would have wanted to, but I've put up some good performances this year out there as well, where I've been able to get myself sort of around that lead a little bit, which I haven't been able to do before. So I feel like gradually it's just moving in the right direction, and I think I'm trending quite nicely.
So you're in the middle of a five-week stretch this week. Week three in Jamaica, you played the Memorial, then, of course, in the Dominican Republic last week, Jamaica now. But two big weeks coming up in the next fortnight too for you, mate.
Yeah, 100%. I had a shocker of a week of Memorial. It's a course that I really, really like. I got to play it last year and played well. And just one of those weeks, just golf happens sort of thing. And played well last week, playing in Jamaica this week, so hopefully another good one. But then I play the Travelers Championship next week in Connecticut, followed by the Quicken Loans Championship in Washington, D.C. So once again, some great opportunities around some really good golf courses with really good fields. And if I keep playing well, I played well last week, and that's what I had the opportunity to maybe take Jamaica off this week and prepare. But when I start playing well, I feel like ride the momentum a little bit, and hopefully I can keep doing that and take that through those next two PGA Tour starts.
Who else is down there of the Australians? Brady Watt's playing there, right?
Yeah, Brady's playing down here. I mean, he hasn't played many events this year. He's skipped it a lot, so I'm not sure exactly, and I haven't even seen him this week. So there's a Troy Kennedy Monday qualified this week, so other than that, it's just me, so I'm a bit of a lone wolf idea.
So is it mainly just South American players, or is it a whole bunch of American kids, or who's playing there mainly?
No, mostly U.S. players, and there are quite a few South Americans too, but I'd say in a, say, 156-man field, there's probably 80 to 90 Americans, 40 South American players, and then the other 20 or so are from around the world.
And last one from me before we let you go. Anybody who's kind of watched you play golf through these kind of formative years, Ryan, you know, knows you can play just about any shot. You know, you can string together birdies. You know, you can take on a golf course, but you can also chuck in a, you know, like a double here and there, and momentum that you can get on can kind of be lost, you know, pretty quickly as well. Is that, you kind of feel like that's the way you're always going to play your game? Like, you know, not all or nothing, but, you know, go for it when you're feeling good? Or will you kind of learn maybe just to kind of temper all of that a little bit on the way through? Have you got a view on that?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's just something it takes time. I think a lot of these courses that I've been able to play out on the PGA Tour are very, very hard, and people don't quite realize how hard. They look at a score and go, gee, he plays off plus five of Victoria. Why isn't he shooting 5 under every time he steps out on the PGA Tour? But it's not like that. They're hard courses, and a lot of the time it doesn't take a lot to make a big number. And these guys who have been out here for a while learn these golf courses very well, learn how to manage the games very well. So their score, they eliminate the big numbers, eliminate the mistakes, and that, like you said, keeps a bit of momentum going in a round that is maybe sort of teeter-tottering between being good and not so good. So, yes, that will be something that over time I think that I'll learn, but for me, I take every time that I can shoot something mid-60s out there, I take positives from that, because the more I can make the bad scores better, I can bring a 75 into a 72, but it's harder to bring a 70 into a 66, 65. So I'm pretty happy that I've been able to shoot a few rounds in the mid-60s, and I've just got to be able to do that over sort of four rounds at the moment.
Ryan, one of the things I'm sure is going to warm a lot of listeners' hearts here is that you spent your first full year away last year, and you realised your Australian-ness, for want of a better phrase here. Like, you basically said afterwards, you know, I need to come home more, and I need to realise what makes me Ryan Ruffles and what makes me whole, and that involves a lot more travel back to Australia, which is good for us future tournaments, of course. But also through the year, you've come back a little bit, and you managed to sneak in a couple of footy games, I believe, and just be a Melbourne boy again.
Yeah, that's something that I missed last year. It was such a hectic year, so many different. There's a start here, and I had to be ready to go, or a start there, and then Q schools and stuff like that. It was such a hectic year, and I never got to go back. And towards the end of the year, I could feel it really wearing on me. So I've made a bit of a conscious effort this year to get back home. I've already been back home twice. Got to see my mates from school. Got to go, like you said, to a few footy games, which was awesome. And now my best mate from back home, Josh Hetherington, he's coming over to go to college over in the US, and he's going to come a month or two early and come live with me for a couple months. And I'm also living with Curtis Luck at the moment. We're living together in Orlando. So all that stuff just keeps it a bit more Australian, which is nice because you definitely miss it when you're over here for too long.
Mate, good to see you. Don't think for one second that people over here aren't, on a daily basis from kind of Thursday through Sunday, checking to see what you're doing. It's all people who, obviously listen to a podcast like this and, love the game over here, are very aware of what you and so many of those young Australian players are doing, at the moment, and we're really invested in it. So you might be a long way from home, but you're not out of mind, mate. So we really appreciate you joining us on the show. And as Hazy said, you're halfway through a really busy five-week stretch. Hopefully the next couple of weeks are going to be exactly what you want them to be. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it, and thanks for all the support.
Hi, this is Sherelle McMahon. Swing Fit is the fun, healthy, social way for women to get started in golf. You'll learn the basics of the golf swing and how to putt over a six-week program and get your whole body moving through yoga and Pilates-style exercises. You don't need any golf knowledge or equipment. Simply turn up in comfy clothing and get started. You'll be surrounded by like-minded people and receive constant support. So get outdoors, meet new friends, and learn a sport that you can play for the rest of your life. To find a program near you, visit swingfit.com.au.
Walking the fairways and the greens with the Aussie stars at home and away. Golf Australia's Inside the Ropes.
Good to hear from young Ryan Ruffles. Don't forget, there are state-specific shows as well as the national podcast you can listen to. Head to golf.org.au or Google your state's website to listen to the various state versions of Inside the Ropes. And you can follow us on Twitter. I know, we're all massive Twitter users. I know Clates is engaged. Follow us at Inside the Ropes on Twitter and send in any questions you've got. We'll try and get to them on the way through, which would be great.
Great result for Ryan, as we mentioned there last week, second on the Latino American Tour. Another good result for Ollie Goss up on the McKenzie Tour in Canada, starting to find his form again. Ollie, hopefully we'll get him on in a few weeks' time, but he went away with so much promise a few years ago, battled a little bit by his own admission, was in the mix vaguely after third round in Victoria on Vancouver Island, and faded a little bit, albeit in the last round. But good to see him sort of up and about.
Clates, these young guys that kind of achieve notoriety in their own backyard in a place like Australia at a young age, and then they go a long way from home, whether it used to be, in your day, a lot went to Europe and a lot went to America. No one goes to Europe anymore for some reason. It seems like it's for some reason. I'm not sure
bizarre.
Why.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
What is, I'll maybe ask you that in a minute, but what is the biggest what are the biggest roadblocks they run into or pitfalls they encounter when they take their game onto these international tours?
Well, they run out of money a lot of times. They're not good enough, quite, some other times. And I think there's an obsession with America, an unhealthy obsession with America. I think if you're really good, go to America, absolutely. But look, Todd Sinnott, he won the Myanmar Open. If someone had said, would you rather win the Australian Open or the Myanmar Open, they'd think you're completely mad. What do you mean? Well, the Myanmar Open was much more useful to Todd Sinnott. But a three-year exemption in Japan, now he can go make some money. And Japan's a good tour. I mean, Brendan Jones made a fortune up there. Steve Conran's made a fortune up there. No one knows they've done it, but they have. So if you're playing professional golf, the first obligation is to make money at it. So I think a lot of guys have fallen into the trap of, not that you would criticise them for going there, but they've fallen into the web of the web.com tour. And they've never got out. Aaron Price and, there were the whole stream of guys who, Steve Allen, Matty Goggin, they've gone back and forward, but who I think would have had Marcus Fraser type, Roger Davis type, Brett Rumford careers in Europe. Great careers where they made a lot of money and played well. But, you know, there's whether you call that an unhealthy obsession, but America seems – there were so many kids who see America as the only place to play professional golf. And sure, it might be the best place, and it's a place where you can make the most money if you're a great player. But Europe's a tremendous tour.
And with full kudos to the PGA Tour of Australasia for orchestrating a relationship with the European Tour on a handful of events now, that most notably, obviously, the Australian PGA Championship, and we keep mentioning Nathan Holman, but now Fiji and the Perth Super Sixes as well. And, you know, it's a great pathway out. And we saw Matt Griffin, through his order of merit, win on the PGA Tour of Australasia, get out and get to play the WGCs and get to play at Jack's Place. And, you know, it's really important that they, you know, use the local tours and the regional tours to get out to places other than the States. I couldn't agree with Clates more.
But, you know, I mean, Japan's a tremendous tour. I mean, good courses, great crowds, great events, really good players. I mean, I don't care where you go. If you're playing against the local guys on their local court, they're hard to beat.
Mm.
You know, that clown Grayson Murray who had a slap at the...
yeah,
you know,
embarrassing. I mean, Kelly Craft embarrassed himself globally.
Go pack your bags up. Go live in Europe for 9 months a year away from your McDonald's and your Burger King and your Holiday Inns and your Hertz rental cars. And go, you know, try play professional golf on the road like most other people do.
Yeah, well, go,
and
if it's
see
so,
how you go.
Exactly. If it's so easy, go over there and get your exemption into events and get your world rankings points. If it's that easy to get it done, go over there and do it.
You know, I mean, look, Alex Noren, I mean, they're tremendous players. I mean, you know, they haven't won in America yet, but I mean, you know, there's so many good players in Europe.
It's open invitation to you, Grayson, if you want to come on and discuss your thoughts with us on Inside the Ropes. Yeah, by the way.
So, quick wrap of you mentioned.
I think he votes for Donald Trump as well.
We've got to keep staying away from that.
Yeah, we're not allowed to talk politics. No, we don't. People don't like it when you do. So you mentioned Europe. The Lioness Open was played. Dylan Fratelli wins at 12 under. Ryan McCarthy was the best Australian at tied 23.
Hmm.
I've never laid my eyes on Ryan McCarthy. He could stand up in my porridge and wouldn't know what he looks like.
That's right? He was a good amateur.
Yeah, he was.
So the classic example of what happened to that guy? Where did he go?
Yeah.
And he pops up and it's like, well, he's been grinding out and playing and he's still, you know, he's a good player. He was a really good amateur.
Fantastic amateur. He was a contender in the Master of the Amateurs a few years ago at Royal Melbourne. And a Tasmanian kid who probably could have chucked it in about 2 years ago, three years ago. And he's fought through a couple of injuries and he's starting to pay dividends.
So mid-20s, that type?
Yeah, he'd be 22.
Yeah, early 20s, yeah. So he's young.
Part of the problem is that Ryan was talking about, you know, he turns pro at 17 or 18 because there is no point playing amateur golf anymore because there are no career amateurs. So you're playing against your mates. I mean, we learn a lot from guys like Tony Gresham and Kevin Hartley who are proper great career amateurs. So you didn't feel like you were turning, you know, you were just playing against your contemporaries all the time. But in amateur golf now, it's just a bunch of kids playing. So there is no point Ryan Ruffles playing amateur golf.
So you're a big advocate for letting pros play pennant golf?
Like I just think we should all play together, or just golfers, let's play. Yeah. But, that debate got hijacked and I got accused of facilitating it, was that pros should play pennant. My argument always was members should play pennant.
Yeah, right.
So if you're a member of the club, you can play pennant. I'm a member at Metro. I pay the same fees everywhere. I venture to suggest I'm not breaking the rules of amateur status by paying my full fees at Metro like perhaps some of... there's been some dodgy stuff going on over the years, no doubt, with fees being paid. But, you know, I think we all should just play against each other. So rather than the debate being hijacked into he wants pros to play pennant, I just want people who are members of clubs to play pennant.
Mm.
What's wrong with that?
So, in a Grayson Murray in his love of McDonald's, Daniel Berger wins the St. Jude. There you go. July 8th.
Yeah, very good,
wasn't
very
it?
Good.
Daniel Berger goes back-to-back at St. Jude. Noteworthy, he doesn't win a lot. Like, he's not winning six or seven times a year. But when a guy goes back-to-back at an event, clearly he likes the course and he likes that event. But pretty noteworthy when somebody does something. I don't know, Hendy's trying to do it in Asia this week at the Queen's Cup.
Yep.
We should stop and say, well done.
Absolutely. He's a good player, Daniel Berger, at that next level down. I'm not sure he's convinced he's ever going to contend at WGC,
what's the other connection with Ryan Ruffles? There's a connection with Ryan Ruffles there.
Go on.
Well, both their fathers were top 50 tennis players in the world.
Is that right?
Was it Jay Berger? Yeah, he was a...
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So, and the quarter sisters, obviously. I mean, there's a real connection between golf and tennis now.
But his dad might have been El Guy Berger.
No,
not at all.
Jay Berger, yeah.
We're going all right at the moment?
We're getting a little bit loose. But
so the best of the Australians over there on the PGA Tour was Adam Scott. Now, he shoots 64 in the second round. I don't know whether you guys have seen enough of Scotty in recent weeks. You would think that somebody hits the ball as straight as he hits the ball, off the tee in particular and into greens. Is he going into the US Open in the sort of nick that he needs to go into to be a serious, serious contender?
I think he's going in there knowing that he's hitting the ball as well as he has for probably 2 years. I think he's also going in and knowing that his putter is about as, you know, about 220 degrees negative on the Kelvin scale.
Right, okay.
No, he's
that's
right.
Not, that doesn't fill you with a lot of confidence.
He'll go well this week. I think it's perfect for him.
The course should set up perfectly for him because it puts a demand on precise irons in.
You've got to play at the US Open. You can get away with decent putting, not spectacular putting. I mean, decent putting will get it done.
True, but he
greens and regulations the key, right?
Well, yeah, and you've got to make the 6 foot putt on the. Now, Jeff talking about Mickelson hitting the great shot to win a tournament. At some point, you've got to get it in from 6 foot at the 15th, 16th, or 17th, or 18th holes, which is what Jeff did at Wingfoot and what. Montgomery and Mickelson conspicuously failed to do.
It's why Jason Day is such a good US Open player historically. Like, he's always been there. Adam Scott hasn't been. So I've got my question marks. I really want him to do well, but I've just got my doubts.
He plays well in the Masters and the British Open, where the courses are better set up, arguably.
There you go. LPGA Tour, Araya Jatanagan beats Lexi Thompson and Inji Chun in a... Set us straight on this a couple of weeks ago?
No, that was Shan Shan Fung.
Oh, it was too. Yeah, no, you did right. Yeah. Minji is in contention, has four bogeys on the back nine to finish, you know, top 10, tie seven, I think she was in the end. She's knocking on the door, isn't she? She's a good thing to stick her nose right in the frame at some stage.
Minji's good.
She's, I reckon, had a couple of weeks off earlier in the year where it wasn't her normal game, but she's got it back. It's a matter of time until she gets back in the top podium, I reckon. Yep.
And Sue's going to go. She's ready now.
Is she?
She's ready to go now. Yep, she's.
Yeah. Why do you say that, Clay? You've got the inside.
Well, because she changed her swing a lot at Christmas time, and I thought the Australian Open was a bit of an aberration, really, as well as she played there. I thought it would take her longer to get it bedded in, but I think now she seems like she's much happier. I think, you know, she's got a new caddy who's great. Christina Kim's boyfriend, New Zealander, Duncan French, who's great. So I think she's about ready to play some good golf.
What's his nickname?
What is his nickname? Don't know.
Because we don't call him by their name.
Frenchie, probably. No, I'm not sure.
Jamie Arnold goes okay again on the week. We mentioned him a couple of weeks ago. The bloke who won it, the German, Stephen Jager, won it by a fair way. Well, he won by two, but first and second were a fair way away from the rest of the field. But tie 4-7 under. He just keeps putting these results. I don't know where he sits in the standings. We'll get that for you next week. But
becoming more consistent, though, isn't
he? Yeah, he's sort of getting himself a lot of top 20s, getting now some closer to top 10s. Yeah. He's doing some stuff over there that shouldn't go. I noticed the one guy I should mention to you in that tournament. Go on.
I was going to say I was going to keep taking you around the amateur world, but you keep going.
Can I just mention Mark Hensby? Mark Hensby, who you don't see.
He shot 66, didn't
he? He finished top 20. In this week of all weeks, the week leading into a US Open, he nearly won a US Open. Was it the Michael Campbell US Open?
He had 1 year, he finished third or fourth at Augusta.
Yeah.
He made a complete hash of the fourth at St Andrews, made like a nine and finished in the
top 20, I reckon.
Yeah, he had 1 year where he just played a blinder in the majors.
He finished third. He finished third at the US Open that year with a sluggish final round. I reckon Tiger and Campbell both did him by about four or five in the final round, but he only got beaten by about three or four in that tournament. So he's a bit of a blast from the past, turning the clock back, Mark Hensby.
We might try and get him on, I reckon.
It'd be a good story.
I think he had a bad divorce, didn't he? I think he had a dodgy divorce.
You can ask him about that.
He did. I think that kind of threw him off.
We'll get you back on.
That threw him for a loop, I think, for a bit.
We'll get you back on. There's no such thing as a good one, is there?
No.
I'm not sure.
No, neither do I. And hopefully I never do.
On the amateur side
of
the
ball,
before we go. Murray, a bit of a link. Becky Kay and Karis Davidson. The Kari Webb Series scholarship winners coming up get a trip to the Women's US Open, of course. But they've also been given a shot this week, actually today, in the Korean Women's Open, which is one of the great training grounds for young pros, obviously. So that's a great result for them to get a start in that field. So that's a huge win for them. Some of their female colleagues are slugging it out as we speak in the Women's British Amateur. Of course, we're recording this on Thursday morning, depending on when you're listening. Olivia Klein is the only one who made it through to the match play phase. So she'll take on a Norwegian opponent in the round of 64. She gets that done, she'll move on. And pretty tough courses there in Wales, so that's a fantastic result for Olivia. And the boys are just tuning up for theirs. They've had another couple of results. Ben Ferguson did really, really well. A young Perth guy finished second at the St Andrews Lynx Trophy. It's a fantastic achievement. Third, beg your pardon. And David Micheluzzi, who will get on at some point, and he's knocking on the door. He's just starting to become a lot more consistent with his game. I don't think it's too long before he takes the big pro plunge.
There's a lot to look forward to. A few of the girls involved, continually involved over on the Symetra. We'll continue to have a chat about all of that on the way through, but time's on the fly. Clates, you're going to stick around for the Victorian version. So thanks so much for being part of the national version of Inside the Ropes. Always good to have you as part of the show, mate.
Thank you.
Mike Clayton joining us. Hazy, always good to see you, big fella.
Thanks, mate.
And thank you for tuning in. Don't forget, subscribe to the many and varied formats to the show that you can, particularly iTunes, Google Play for Android users, and Stitcher. And if you do subscribe on iTunes, make sure you drop in a little review. And if it's a good one, i.e. five stars, we'll mention your name next week. Thanks for your time. We'll see you then.